Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, interest rates. This topic isn't too mathematical, but it is kind of one of those topics where you have to remember and memorize certain relationships. And also, this harkens back in several places to your economics class work. And you'll see that here in a while. A quick look at the numbers just to get the happiness of our day started here. Forgive me for my late start here. Let me pull up Yeehaw Finance. This interest rates topic drove me crazy because some of my data sets that the government used to provide aren't there now, so I'm kind of scrambling to find where I can get that good data. But as far as this day goes, it's a bull day or bear day.
Bear.
It was kind of iffy how there for a while. It's been kind of a roller coaster. I was betting on a bear day, and so I've had joy and sadness back and forth as my bet on the bears kind of came and went. But you can see that this is one of those days where, interestingly enough, the Dow is the strongest down. And then the S&P 500 is not quite as bad. And then the NASDAQ isn't as bad at all. So you're seeing that whatever news is hitting the markets right now, it seems to be impacting the larger companies. At least the perception is that it's worse news for large companies than it is for smaller companies. Kind of an interesting inversion from the usual. Much of this is being propelled by rumors about the Federal Reserve. I haven't seen anything official. I haven't been looking. But some of my traders this morning that talked to me in the early morning were saying that the Fed was having an emergency meeting, which would mean that they are thinking of doing an interest rate increase. And that's the subject of today's lecture, is interest rates and how they are affected. One of the ways they are affected is by the Federal Reserve itself. As you can see, the markets are down, so money is going out of equities. And we can see crude oil. Look at that. It actually has now, it's trying to find 95 a barrel today. And that means a pretty good reason to believe we'll see 100 by the time spring break happens. Higher gas prices, higher jet fuel prices, the whole nine yards coming your way. And then after 100 is in the rearview mirror. Good Lord, there's dream talk of 125 to 150 by summer. And boy, that'll bring up the prices. But as you can see, gold and silver were both up. So there's some money going into the metals right now, moving out of equities and into the metals. But you see that the yields on treasuries have gone up 4 basis points, which means prices are going down. So investors are kind of pulling back from bonds right now as the yields rise. That indicates that there is some belief that the Fed is going to bump interest rates pretty quickly here. London and Tokyo both had bad days to start with. But once that bad news came through, it really, the markets didn't have any more to say for the day, no more news. So it's one of those things where it looks for all the world like investors are pulling out of equities, they're pulling out of bonds, maybe throwing a little money at the metals. But overall, there's like a wait and see attitude hanging around right now, getting out of the way of the worst that could happen if interest rates are pushed up. But from there, who knows? There were a couple of these supposed investment gurus in the last 24 hours who were saying that the end is here, the stock markets are going to crash, the world's coming to an end. And I don't buy that for a minute. I still think we're not in the worst of any kind of a bear market yet, but we'll see what happens over the next few days. Now, as far as interest rates are concerned, start out with a few basic definitions just to get the ball rolling. And you'll hear me tighten these definitions up over the next couple of classes. The first things first is that interest rates represent an opportunity cost of funds. They're an opportunity cost. That's all they are. Where's my TA? She's gone. Okay. So, first things first. Interest rates are affected by opportunities. Now, the book says production opportunities, but it's broader than that. If you are to give up money for some reason, then you need a reason, because otherwise you could use that money yourself right away. So if we need to get you to give up money for the future, we have to have we have to offer you something. And if you have a lot of opportunities to use that money now, then we have to offer you more. If there aren't too many opportunities, then we don't have to offer you as much. Now remember, interest rates are you'll hear me say they're the price of money. Actually, they're the rental rate of money. You rent money when you borrow it. Just like a wage rate isn't a price of you, it's just a rental rate on you. Now another one that is important here is Federal Reserve policy. Now the Federal Reserve, and I'll get into a lot of what the Federal Reserve does later, but the Federal Reserve has a strong effect on short-term interest rates. That effect diminishes as time, when we talk about longer term, but they are the driving force of the short term on interest rates. The way it works is this, and I'll give you an example from just recent times. This is money, and this is what we call the real interest rate. Now, the real interest rate, we can't see it. It's not so much a theoretical as it is something that is always embedded in something bigger. It's very much like in physics, if you know anything about quantum mechanics, we can talk about quarks. Quarks are the building blocks of all subatomic particles and all their different flavors and charms and ups and downs and all that. We can't see them. We probably never will be able to see one, but we know they're there because we know their effect. We know the real interest rate is there. We just cannot see it, but we can certainly see its effects. If I were to say, here's the demand for money. Now, this is the problem. Getting a real demand curve is actually, even in microeconomics, I worked on getting a demand curve for something as simple as gold. It was a nightmare statistically and probability theory-wise. So this is where the real problem is with actually seeing a real interest rate, is knowing what the country's demand for money is. You'd have to collect data, and it'd be shifting on you every day as you try to collect more data. Okay, but there is a demand for money. We know there is, obviously. Now, if you remember your macroeconomics, the supply of money is perfectly inelastic in the short run. In other words, there's a pile of money out there. On this day, there's this much money. On another day, there might be some more. Now, the two of these intersect to create a real interest rate. In other words, where the supply of money is cleared by the demand for money. Just basic economics kind of stuff. Now, in some eras, the Federal Reserve will print a lot of money. In which case, what they are doing is they are trying to stimulate the economy. So they might shift the demand, the supply of money out, and that will lower the real interest rate. That's how it works. Now, to give you recent history, and you can go back to my podcast if you would like, in about 2016, the Fed was juicing the economy a little just to get it a little boost. Going into the election, the Fed does things just to make sure the economy is smooth. No one can accuse the Fed of causing a recession to affect the election or anything like that. So they juiced it, but the problem was that the economy was beginning to heat up a little bit. By 2017, we were starting to see inflation sneaking in. The economy was getting a little on the hot side. So what the Fed should have done at this point is to back down on the money supply, to cut it back, which would raise interest rates and slow down the economy a little bit. That's active monetary policy. When the economy is getting a little too hot, you pull back on the money supply to slow it down. When the economy is getting sluggish, you push it out a little bit to boost it up a little bit. Well, the Fed should have started to back down in 2017. But the president at that time did something that had never even been heard of before. He threatened to fire the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board if they didn't do what he wanted, which was to just juice the economy like hell to keep interest rates low, to keep the economy humming so he would look like a hero. And the Fed never stopped. It just started printing money. And by the time we got to the lockdown era, the Fed didn't dare back down from it. So we were getting a large liquidity overhang, and that creates inflation. You could hear my podcast. I was saying by 2018 and 19, I was saying we're going to get inflation. There's too much money chasing the need for it. So that's what causes inflation. And now and then, of course, we've got all these COVID stimulus checks and the infrastructure bill. And so there is a massive overhang of money. The interest rate, the real interest rate, is very low. And that is a problem because that's what causes inflation. Now, the real interest rate, we don't see it because it's always, always going to be matched with this thing, IP. Now, the book says inflation premium. That's not correct. It is the expected inflation premium. That is what is in there. In other words, inflation is a pain in the ass. What's much, much more worrisome is the expectation of inflation, because that's what makes banks charge higher interest rates for long-term loans. That's what makes you want a higher wage. It's your expectation that there will be inflation that will erode your purchasing power over the next year or whatever. So that expectation of inflation is locked in with the real interest rate. So as you can see, in the short run, the Fed can lower the real rate, and there's no inflation right away. But once that expectation gets in there, then this risk-free rate starts to rise. Now, the risk-free rate is like the foundation of all interest rates. You'll see it later in the course. It shows up in all these formulas. Now, these aren't really complicated formulas, but it's everywhere. This underlying substrate, and all interest rates rise and fall on that pad of the risk-free rate. Now, the risk-free rate itself is, again, something that we can't see directly. But we have something that looks very, very close to it, that is almost always right about it. We call that a proxy. So if we want to use one of these formulas in real life in a real problem, we use this proxy for the risk-free rate. Now, the proxy, that thing that is very, very similar to the risk-free rate, is the yield on a short-term government treasury bill. Now, like I said, there used to be a site that the government was running that had this risk-free rate, these treasury bill rates right there where you could see them. And I tried to find it for the last class, and it's just not there anymore. That one place at the on the government site. It's not there. The best that I can do, here's a 1 year, which is the one we use as the proxy for R-sub-F. The yield on a 1 year treasury. Right now, you can see that as of today, that's 1.03%. It was so low in like a couple of years ago that it was negative a couple of times, a negative interest rate of all things. In other words, you would lend the government money and pay them for the honor of lending them money. That's insane. Right now, you see that. Do you notice that the Fed has already begun the process of clamping down? Do you see that? Now, on Friday, it eased back a little bit because there was some sentiment that the Fed was going to wait to raise interest rates. Today, it will be back up there. So you see that right now, it's at about 1.03%. Probably by the end of today, it'll be back up to about 1.07%. But one way or the other, that gives you an idea of what this substrate, all interest rates ride on that pad. Because, I mean, okay, now why is the government's one-year treasury bill risk-free? Well, the government, there are three things that can make it not risk-free. There can be default possibility, liquidity, you couldn't sell the thing, or a maturity. And I'll talk about those in a minute. But what I point out here is that a treasury bill is completely risk-free. The government is not going to default on its debt. It won't, despite these conspiracy theorists who say, well, the government's going to default on it. No, it's not. First of all, if the government needs to pay off a debt, it will just simply, it could raise taxes. If it can't do that, it will just, the Fed will print money to pay back people who lend it money. And if the Fed's printing presses are broken, we will just attack another country on false premises and liquidate their assets and pay it back that way. And yes, we have done all three over the 200 years that we have, plus years we have been a nation. 250, it's getting close to that now, God. Okay, so yeah, this is risk-free. It's as close to risk-free as you can get. Okay, so that's the risk-free rate. And we use this, as a matter of fact, when we go, there will be these formulas called the capital asset pricing model. And one of the numbers you put in is R sub F, the risk-free rate. So what do we use for that? We just run over these tables and find what it currently is. Okay, we'd put in 0.0103 for that number in there. There's a practical use for this. Now, for everything I do here, it's going to come down to things that you would actually know. Now, the other two things that can affect interest rates are, first of all, risk. Risk is the driving force of interest rates. As a matter of fact, when we measure a company, we measure it in terms of what we call a discount rate. How big the interest rate is we use for present values. The higher the discount rate, we are saying the greater the risk. This is one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. Now, I've said that three times, so it's probably really important. Risk, higher risk means higher expected return. You are not going to throw money at a risky project unless you expect something good to come out of it. If it's a safe project, you don't expect much. Like a treasury bill pays 1.03%, big whoop-de-doo. But then again, it's also risk-free. Now, if you threw your money at a junk bond, you're darn well going to expect a higher interest rate than that on a junk bond because you're taking a greater risk. So, in other words, when we go to look at interest rates, any interest rate you are going to look at will be the risk-free rate plus something we call the risk premium. The pieces that make up the risk in a measurable way. Everything we do, we try to put into measurable terms so that we're not just talking out our butts. We actually have the math behind it, the physics, the engineering, to make it something that's real. And you will see that there are three pieces to this risk premium. But one way or the other, risk does drive interest rates. Higher risk, higher R. Always. And the fourth one is the inflation. That's that thing right there. And I'm going to put up here, which the book seems to keep forgetting to put in, is that that is expected inflation. You see, as I said, inflation is a pain in the butt. What's worse is when the inflation gets embedded as an expectation. Because then, even if the Fed here says, well, we're going to crack down and clamp down on the money supply, you know what? If that inflation has been around long enough, most of the markets are going to say, yeah, sure you are. We're still going to jack up our prices next year. We're still going to put in a big inflation premium in our interest rates we charge on loans because that's just how markets work. The Fed has to sustain until the economy is choking before that inflation premium, that expected inflation premium, begins to drain out. This was what happened, and I'll go through the whole story with you in a subsequent lecture. We started a long time ago, back in the 50s, we had a very moderate president. He didn't want to spend a lot of money. He didn't believe in cutting taxes. He wanted to keep sort of a straight and narrow. His name was Dwight Eisenhower. As we say, the last of the great moderate Republicans. He said, no, I'm not going to give you any more. He gave a tax cut at the beginning of his administration in 1954. And then the Republicans in Congress screaming, even his vice president, screaming for more tax cuts. Tax cuts, tax cuts, we got to have more tax cuts. And he said, shut up. But on the other side, he said to the left and the liberals, they were yelling, we've got to get underway with programs for the poor, with anti-discrimination, and all of this kind of stuff. And he said, no, we're not going to do that either. I'm not spending money, and I'm not cutting taxes. And so we had the Fed was able to maintain the money supply very nicely during that period. And then we got Jack Kennedy, classic. He was a neoliberal, and he wanted to spend money on moon programs, social welfare, and he wanted to have a good fight with the communists who were beginning to slither around in Southeast Asia in this backwater hole called Vietnam. And so money started getting spent. And eventually the Fed started printing money, printing money, printing money. By the time it was over, the inflation was terrible, but what was even worse was expected inflation. Because the Fed kept saying, well, we're going to crack down on the money supply, and they didn't. And so finally, by the time that President Jimmy Carter put in a real asshole as the head of the Fed, that guy said, we're going to cut the money supply. And everyone said, yeah, yeah. expected inflation premium just kept going up. The Feds kept trying to hold it down by lowering the real interest rate, but this expected inflation premium was skyrocketing. And then when Volcker, that chairman, clamped down on the money supply, well, the real rate went through the roof. The expected inflation premium wasn't going anywhere. And so we had a rather ugly interest rate regime of incredibly high rates for a while. But that was eventually the market said, oh, the Fed's serious this time. And finally, this inflation premium began to drain out and the economy began to recover in the early 1980s. I'll get into that more in subsequent lectures. But for now, do know that these are the driving forces in interest rates. There are other factors, and I'm never sure if I should even talk about them. If you take my international finance course, you'll see that there are some other factors that can affect interest rates on an international level. It's not really a major issue, but they can be changed. They can be affected by what are called non-sterile interventions. But that's not really too important here. Okay, the risk premium has three pieces to it. Now, if you're not the government, then you have a chance of defaulting on a loan. You could. So we have to have a little bit of a premium, a little extra boost, juice on the interest rate to reflect that. You, sir, are a safe person. You probably won't default. I won't worry about it, but I'll still put a little in there because something could happen. You, on the other hand, you are a scoundrel. You're probably going to take the money and run. So you see, I have to tailor the interest rate to the type of loan and the type of constituency that takes those loans out. So, for example, a home loan, a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, default premium, would that be high or would that be low? What say you? It would actually be low, and here's why. The loan is backed by an asset. So if you don't pay, the bank gets your house. That's why the default premium on a home loan, a fixed-rate mortgage, is fairly low, pretty darn low. There's two reasons. One is because it's backed by an asset, so that if you default, the bank gets the asset. And even funnier, the one that's really hilarious, is that the people who take out loans, they actually pay an insurance premium that performs and gives the bank the difference between how much they lost on the loan and how much they sell the house for. So, and that's kind of funny because most people don't know that they have the house taken away from them and then the bank is made whole by the insurance the people themselves were paying. It's called MAGIC, Mortgage Assurance Guarantee Corporation. That's one of the places anyway. So anyway, there is a default premium. Like, for example, a AAA corporate bond, high grade, that's going to have a very small default premium. It will still have one because there's always a chance, but it will be fairly modest. Now, a riskier corporation, say an A grade bond, would have a higher default premium. So, for example, Netflix a few years back issued 15-year paper. That's a fancy way of saying they borrowed $1.2 billion. My God, that the interest rate on that was appallingly high. I mean, it was just, as a matter of fact, it was so high we call it junk bond. You're not supposed to say junk bond. You're supposed to say high yield. Okay, but it was junk, Netflix. And it was because there was a sense that, one, Netflix was not all that safe as a borrower. And one of the reasons it wasn't safe is there's a limit to how far Netflix can go with new markets and with jacking up its prices before people start walking away from Netflix and go to other services. So Netflix borrowed $1.2 billion at a pretty stiff interest rate, and that was a default premium. Now, look at some other kinds of loans. For example, a car loan. There is a higher default premium on a car loan than on a home loan because they're both backed by an asset. If you default, the bank gets your money, gets your asset. The car loan has a slightly, somewhat higher default premium simply because when you drive a new car off the lot, it loses a pretty serious amount of value right away. So right away, you're almost assuredly upside down on your loan. And so if you default very quickly, well, you know, they're going to just take, they're not going to get as much for the car as you owe them. That's just the way it is. Nothing big and serious about that. Let's try this one, a student loan. A student loan. What would you think, sir? Would a student loan have a high default premium or a low default premium? Well, let me ask you this. What happens if you default on a student loan? They send black helicopters and these guys in wetsuits rappel down and they come into your house and they shoot your dog. They won't shoot the cat. The cat's cool. He actually told them where you were. Cats are like that. But they'll garnish your wages. So actually, those are fairly safe. So the default premium is pretty low because they can nail your butt to the wall on those. Try this one. Credit card. You ever see credit card interest rates are ridiculously high? It's because there's no backing. I mean, people default on those all the time, so the default premium is ridiculously high on credit card debt. It's just the way it is with that kind of debt. So you can actually kind of see why interest rates are what they are. Now, once in a while I hear someone say, well, car loans are like, I know a place where I can get a 0.99% APR on a car loan. No, you can't. They're embedding that in the price. Don't do that. The interest rates can be phonied up to look low when they're actually very high. Matter of fact, you're going to see a horrible example of that sometime in the next couple of weeks. But anyway, there's this default premium. The only things that don't have it are government debt. High-grade corporate debt will have a very small premium. The riskier the corporation, obviously, the higher the default premium is going to be. There's that risk-return relationship. Now, the next one here is the liquidity premium, LP. The liquidity premium. If you lend the government $1,000, on a 30-year loan, that would be buying a 30-year treasury bond. That's what it would be. You decide the next day, I don't want to do this. I need that $1,000. You can sell it in the blink of an eye for about $1,000. You're not going to lose anything. So there is virtually no liquidity premium when it is easy to get rid of a loan that you have taken. Still to this day, it kind of amazes me how many people have no idea that when you have a mortgage, you get it at the bank, within a couple of hours to a couple of days, that mortgage has been sold. Banks don't keep mortgages. They sell them in this massive trillions of dollar secondary mortgage market, which takes those loans from thousands of home borrowers every day and balls them up into these ginormous super bonds that are then bought and sold by super ginormous, powerful trusts, countries, corporations, things like that. They're called Ginny Mae's and Fannie Mae's and Freddie Mac's. So in other words, those home loans have pure liquidity. There is this market so that banks don't keep loans. They sell them within hours sometimes. They just get a bunch of people who get home loans one day, they package them up, and they sell them to the secondary mortgage market for the amount that they lent. The bank, well, wait a minute, I make my payments to the bank. No, the bank makes a little money for servicing the loans. But the loan itself has been sold within hours or days. So liquidity premium, there's no extra charge. Now, if you have a hard time, if you lent money in such a way to someone or something where you can't get rid of that real fast if you need the money, then there's a liquidity premium. I borrow from you, sir. So you've got an IOU from me. Good luck trying to find someone who will buy it from you. So you're going to charge me more interest because you're going to be stuck with it for a while. When I was a penny stock broker, I owned a penny stock house many, many years back. We dealt in these little tiny podunk companies. And someone might buy stock from us, stock from me. And then a couple of days later, well, I've been thinking about it, and I want to unload this stock. They bought it from me for $1 a share. And I'd say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll buy it back from you for 70 cents a share. What the hell are you talking about? Hey, find someone else who'll buy that crap company. Call back a few days later, call me a few names that started with mother, and then sell it to me. You see how that's a liquidity premium. You can't unload a lot of these things. If there's a difficult time getting rid of something that you, a debt that you have lent to someone, then you're going to charge some juice on it, some basis points for that. Now, if you're talking about corporate bonds, I mean, even junk bonds, you can get rid of those pretty quickly. If it's a AAA corporate bond, I mean, you can dump it in a blink of an eye. Double A, single A, I mean, even that Netflix paper, it's junk, but you can dump that anytime you want for about what you paid for it, somewhere around there. So, but liquidity premiums show up more in certain types of unusual animals. Matter of fact, government debt has no liquidity premium, especially treasury bills, because they are basically cash. They have the same liquidity. They have the same liquidity level as dollar money. In fact, when banks have, they're supposed to have a certain amount of super safe money in their banks. Well, money, cash, and treasury bills are both counted as being the same super safe, super liquid stuff, tier one. So banks, if they have a lot of money, they can lend it. But if they have a lot of treasury bills, they can't lend that. So that's the only difference between the two. Okay. The last one is the oddball. It's the maturity premium. The maturity premium is a double whammy. It gets worse the longer the loan is. A 1 year will have no 3 month, 1 year, it'll have hardly any maturity premium. A 10 year will have some, 20 more, 30 even more. It is why you will get a better interest rate on a 20-year home loan than you will on a 30-year home loan. It's because of this maturity premium. Now, let me explain what I mean by it's a double whammy. Okay, you, sir, I am a lender. I'm a bank, and you come to me and you say, I should like to borrow money on a home loan for 30 years. I'll say, well, that's good. I will charge you 6%. And you say, okay. So you're cruising along 6%, and I'm expecting, as a bank, that I will get 6% for the next 30 years. My planning horizon. I've got you in that loan. Well, what happens if, say, 3 or 4 years down the road, interest rates on mortgages fall to 4%? You know what you're going to do? You're going to refi. Because you can go to another bank, get the money for 4%, and then pay me off. And there I am holding this money that I thought I was going to get 6% on for 30 years. Now the prevailing rate is 4%. So I've been screwed. So I'm going to make some adjustment to your interest rate because I could get hurt that way. But here's the other side of it. The average homeowner owns a home, especially early on, for about 7 years. So let's say that interest rates were 6% at the time you borrowed. And then about 7 years later, they have gone up to 10%. Well, you see, I as a lender would love to lend that money that I lent to you at 6%. I'd love to lend that out at the prevailing rate of 10%. But you know what? I say, well, he's 7 years in the house. He should be selling soon. No, you're not. You're going to hold on to that house. Because if you sold it, you'd have to get a new mortgage at 10%. You're not going to move. Even though now you know not only have you have you and a significant other, you have five kids, and your brother is now living in the garage, and he's got a garage band that sings grindcore, and every morning they come out wearing gas masks. You'd love to get out from under that mess. But you're not going to, because if you did, it would cost 10% for a new mortgage. So you'll hold on to that house as long as you can. And I would love to have you sell it so I can get that money back and lend it out at 10%. You're not going to do that. So I'm going to be stuck with 6%. So in other words, if interest rates go up or they go down, I as a lender am hurt. And the longer the mortgage, the more likely that one of those two scenarios is going to happen. That's why maturity premium, it's in physics, it's just like a gas. It starts out as small, but as time goes on, there's more and more probability that it will be somewhere other than where it started. And either way, if it's lower or higher, I am hurt. So I will charge juice on an interest rate the longer I have to put up with it, because I assume that I'm going to get hurt. The longer I have that loan with you, the more likely it is I'm going to get burned. So a 20-year, I'm going to charge a lower maturity premium than a 30-year, because there is more probability of an adverse move in interest rates over 30 years than there are over 20 years. So that's the maturity premium sitting there on that. So you put all of those together, and there it is. Every interest rate is driven by these factors here. Now, these two walk together hand in hand. What we're seeing right now, what we have been seeing, is that the Fed was juicing interest rates to keep them low and get them lower, to keep the economy going, especially during the pandemic. It was somewhat reasonable to do that. However, we have now created such a liquidity overhang with all this extra money swirling around, spinning in the economy, that now it's creating inflation. And the Fed has to act before that inflation becomes an expectation of more. You see, if there is a one-time jump in inflation, well, that's one thing when I'm deciding whether to give you a raise. But if we keep seeing more and more inflation, you're going to come in and you are going to expect a higher rate. The company that is going to produce goods for sale in 6 months or a year, it's going to expect that those prices will be higher, so it's going to jack the price up now instead of later, because it's not going to wait for the inflation to hit. That's the problem with inflation, is a skin problem. Expected inflation is a cancer. And once it gets in there, it's going to take a lot for the Fed to convince everyone we're dead serious. And it takes political will to handle it, because the reality is that if the Fed starts to clamp down on the money supply, the real interest rate is going to go up. But expected inflation is not going to go down. It'll just keep going up for a while. So we'll have very high interest rates, which will drive us into a recession. In the current case, how's that going to play out? bet your bottom dollar that's going to play out, and we're going to be slipping into a slow economy, maybe a stagflation type of environment in 2023 and into 2024. And that will be election season. And so the party in power will be blamed for whatever is going to happen. It's happened before in history, and we're just seeing the same story over again. We didn't clip it off when we needed to back in 2017, so then we had to ramp up the money printing presses for the pandemic, and now we've got a nightmare on our hands. And that's what's going to happen, and that'll be about the time when you guys are out there getting jobs, a recession. But don't worry, maybe we'll have a war, so there will be jobs available in Eastern Europe. Postcards. Picks or didn't happen. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.